We've followed the events of the Northern Kingdom, one dynasty after another, one king after another. We've been through the rule of wicked King Ahab and Jezebel and several of their sons. And there has been several men that God has used during this time. One was the prophet Elijah, but right now we are in the ministry of the prophet named Elisha. We pick it up in chapter 6, verse 1. And the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us. Please let us go to the Jordan, and let every man take a beam from there, and let us make there a place where we may dwell." So he answered, "Go." Now, the sons of the prophets, we've talked about this before. In this time period, these are like the seminary students. These are the guys, pastors in training. These are the ministry school students. That's like a school for prophets, and that was that's the label they got labeled. They were called the sons of the prophets. This particular group has outgrown their school campus. That's a way to look at it. It's kind of interesting that the rabbis who teach on this passage say that the increase in the number of disciples was due to the departure of Gehazi. If you've been with us through this, Gehazi was the sidekick of Elisha. He's the guy that went off the rails last week. He's the guy that got all into, he wanted to be rich and famous and get money off of people, and he got leprosy, and he's been booted from the nest. But according to the rabbis, their tradition was that he was a rat. And he used to smack people around in the schools and try to order them around and be Mr. Hoity-toity, you know, and when he left, apparently the school numbers grew. This is the way the rabbis explain this. Whether that's that way or not, I don't know. And it says, the place where we dwell has become too small. Now, we've talked about how Elisha, he's got a traveling ministry. He's not just settled in one place. He spent time in, I'm in the wrong thing. Okay. So, we think that he was in Jericho, and we think that that's the school that they're talking about. And that doesn't look like the right video, but okay. Wait, let's try that again. Okay. I've been watching videos all afternoon trying to figure this stuff out. They're going to have to go to the Jordan to find trees, wood, because Jericho is down in the Jordan Valley, and it's a very dry place. And the only place you're going to see any kind of vegetation naturally is along the Jordan River. And so that's one of the reasons why we think this is in Jericho, that this event is taking place. Verse 3, then one of them said, "Please consent to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." They wanted their teacher to come along. He said, sure, I'll go. So he went down with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. And he cried out and said, "Alas, master, for it was borrowed." So the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick, threw it in there, and he made the iron float. He made the iron float. He's kind of weird. How does he do that? Therefore, he said, "Pick it up for yourself." So he reached out his hand and took it. Now, I got to tell you, some people like, and I do this every once in a while, but some of us teachers, we tend to spiritualize everything and come up with hidden meanings in all these stories. The problem with finding hidden meanings in everything is that it all kind of depends on how you're going to interpret it. You know, what does this mean? What does that mean? And whatever. Nothing just really settles in on me. So let's just talk about what's obvious. He says, "Master, help me." And so Elisha helps him. And this iron head that had been somewhere in the river bottom comes floating up, and he can give it back. He can pay back what he owed. He borrowed the axe head. He borrowed the axe from the guy. Some people if they borrowed something from you and then they lose it, they would say, oh, big deal, wasn't mine anyway, or something like that. Not this guy and not Elisha. They want to get it back. Romans 13:8. We talked about this last week. Oh, no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Pay your debts. And God seemed to be concerned enough to cause an incredible miracle to happen. How did this happen? I do not know. God did it, though. Not Elisha. This is not the power of the force. This is God at work. This is God at work. Strange story. Verse 8 gets even stranger. That's because Elisha is strange. Boy, I can hardly wait to meet that old bald guy. And when we get to heaven. Interesting guy. Now, the king of Syria was making war against Israel. And he consulted with his servants, saying... So the king of Syria, it's up in Damascus. He's consulting with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. And the man of God, that's Elisha, went to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there. Then the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice. In other words, this has happened all the time. Elisha was whispering stuff into the king of Israel, giving him a heads up about all this stuff. Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? There's spies among us. And one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. One of his servants tells him, I don't know. I wonder if it was Naaman. We saw last week, he was the head of the Syrian army, who was healed by God through Elisha. He was healed of leprosy. He'd seen God at work. He'd seen the amazing things that God could do, what God was doing through Elisha. Who knows? Or it could have just been part of Naaman's entourage that had seen this incredible thing happen. Who knows? He says, he tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. How would you like that? If somebody was telling somebody else the things that you are saying in the privacy of your bedroom, or you could even say he was in the bathroom. I mean, the word could be used for something like that. It could be. No electronic bugs in this day. It's not that big of a deal when you realize that God is in this story. God sees, God hears, God knows everything. David wrote, you know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You read my mind. We are really fooling ourselves when we tell ourselves that nobody sees what we're doing when we're alone. And you know what? Every one of us does it. Every one of us has times where we think nobody's watching, I'm just going to do this thing. And you know what, my friends? You are not alone. I have electronic equipment in each of your homes. Well, that would be weird. I do not want that. But you know what? God knows. God sees everything. Ezekiel lived in Babylon, and he has this vision from God of what's happening hundreds of miles away in the temple in Jerusalem. And then God said to me, son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the room of his idols, for they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. In our nation, we are from time to time concerned about privacy laws. We don't want the government spying on us. I get that. I'm not trying to be weird on you here. But sometimes, even if we end up going down the road of Nazi Germany or some kind of a crazy leader who wants to watch and see and know everything that we do, part of me wonders, what am I afraid of? Why would that be a problem for me? Now, if I'm going to get convicted for being a Christian, I hope there's enough evidence. I hope that's not hard to prove. But if I'm going to be convicted for doing bad things, why do I have to be spied on to stop doing this? God already sees you. God already knows. And so here's this king of Syria saying, who's giving away all our good plans? God. God knows. God sees. Verse 13. So he said, the king says, go and see where he is, that I may send and get him. And it was told him, saying, surely he is in Dothan. Now, this is the map I was thinking of. Now, keep in mind, as we've talked about, Elisha has an itinerant ministry. He travels from place to place. He spends time in Jericho, in Gilgal, in Bethel, Samaria, Mount Carmel. He spent time up in Shunem. And now he's currently spending time in the city of Dothan. That's where Elisha is right now. It's about 10 miles north of the capital city of Samaria. So they figure out, they've got spies, their own spies, and they say he's in Dothan. Verse 14, therefore he, this is the king of Syria, sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. In my head, I've always got Elisha, you know, camping out on top of the hill, because the story makes much more sense when the servant gets up in the morning and goes, whoa, and he's looking all around. There is a hill in Dothan. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? We're surrounded, the servant of the man of God. Now, as we mentioned before, Gehazi has been dismissed. So this is not Gehazi. This is some new guy. He's got a new assistant. And he says, what shall we do? I think I detect a hint of panic in his voice. What are we going to do? We are surrounded by the king of Syria. You know, it is not unusual for people who should know better to panic. This guy should have, I would imagine he's known Elisha a little bit. He should know a little bit about Elisha. I think about the story where Jesus and the disciples are on the sea and a storm comes up and Jesus is asleep in the boat and the guys are panicking. They're freaking. They're going, we're going to die. We're going to die. And they wake Jesus up and he says, what's your problem? You know, it's like, what am I, chopped liver? You know, oh, ye of little faith. And he speaks a word and he calms the sea. I think hopefully at this point in my life, if I were literally with Jesus in a boat, I hopefully wouldn't panic. But knowing me, I probably would. I probably still would panic. Our faith, my friends, is imperfect for all of us. Our faith is imperfect, and we will be just like this servant. We don't want to get too hard on him, because we all will panic at times. Verse 16, so he answered. Elisha is answering the servant. He says, do not fear. For those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Those who are with us. Elisha is aware of something that his servant is not. Elisha is aware that they are not alone. There is an old movie that just sticks with me, and it's funny. I don't know why it sticks with me. It wasn't probably the world's greatest movie. Back in the 1980s, there was a movie called My Bodyguard. It was one of those school, about kids in school. And it was about a kid who's constantly being hassled by the school bully, a kid whose name was Moody. That was the name of the school bully. Until one day things change, and the little kid turns tables on the bully.
Planned ahead because you're dead. Look at this shirt. Look what you did to this.
Moody, I'd like you to meet my bodyguard. Anything you want to say to me, talk to him first.
I like that. He doesn't have to be afraid of the bully because he's got somebody bigger standing right over his shoulder. And I like that line. Anything you want to say to me, talk to him first. My friends, we've got a bodyguard. You may not see him all the time, but he's there. David wrote, "The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him and delivers them." Paul wrote, "And what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" Elisha's not freaked out at all. Not freaked out at all. I mean, there was the stories about Elijah when they tried to arrest Elijah. They sent 50 men at a time to arrest Elijah, and he called down fire from heaven. We haven't seen yet what will happen with Elisha. I kind of like Elisha's things a little better. Verse 17, "And Elisha prayed." I love this. "Elisha prayed and said, 'Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see.' Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha." And so the servant's eyes are opened. He sees what Elisha sees. And all around the mountain, horses and chariots of fire, they are not alone. He catches a glimpse into the heavenly realm. Chariots of fire, it was a chariot of fire that had taken Elijah into heaven. When we talk about, we'll see this at the death of Elisha. We saw this at the death of Elijah, when Elijah died, Elisha said, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." I think he's talking about the invisible realm. The same thing would be said when Elisha died, because these guys are connected to these chariots of God. You may not see them, but the angels are there. Jacob had a dream on his journey. It says he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And after Jacob woke up that night, he awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." You're not alone. You're not alone. And as God's child, he sees you. He knows. I don't know if you've got armies of angels protecting you like Elisha did. You only need one. I mean, shoot. One of the angels, you know, had pretty nasty with a sword. One angel killed 185,000 Assyrians. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot. You're not alone. I know we think we are, but we're not. He said, he prayed, "Open his eyes." I think that's a good thing to think about, my friends. Things are not always what they seem. Maybe a bully standing in front of you, but there may be something different that you don't see. You may be facing an impossible financial crisis. God sees something different. And I think that a key to getting a hold of this is prayer, learning to pray. Look at what Paul prayed in Ephesians 1. He says, "Therefore I also, after I heard of your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love for all the saints, do not cease to give thanks for you, making mention of you in my prayers, that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give to you the spirit of wisdom and revelation in the knowledge of him." Revelation, that's opening your eyes. "That the eyes of your understanding may be enlightened," being enlightened, "that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe, according to the working of his mighty power." See, his prayer is that your eyes would be opened to the kind of things that God has for you. That you're not alone. God has resources. He has ways to direct. You're not alone. I think that would be a great way for us to pray for ourselves. I think it's a great way to pray for others as well. Verse 18. "So when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord." Now watch this. This is just the opposite. It's just the opposite. It's like lights on, lights off. Lights on, lights off. He's going to turn lights off right now. "Look," he said to the Lord, "strike this people, I pray, with blindness." And he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. So he prays for the servant's eyes to be open. He prays for these guys' eyes to be closed, for them to be blinded. "Now Elisha said to them, 'This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek.' But he led them to Samaria." So he leads them, you know, is it 10 miles away? "This is not the way." Now, I kind of wonder if it looks like this.
"How long have you had these drawings?"
"About 3 or 4 seasons."
"They're up for sale if you want them."
"Let me see your identification."
"You don't need to see his identification."
"We don't need to see his identification."
"These aren't the droids you're looking for."
"These aren't the droids we're looking for."
"He can go about his business."
"You can go about your business."
"Move along."
"Move along. Move along."
See, it's real. It really doesn't happen because it happens in the movie. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not trying to say that Elisha is a Jedi master. He's just a guy. This is not about Elisha doing anything. Elisha prays, and God does the work. That's where the movies kind of get us tweaked a little bit. We start thinking these guys have awesome cosmic powers. It's not Elisha. It is God. But it is kind of like that, isn't it? He prays. God blinds these people. And they're not totally blind. They're able to walk. They can see things. But somehow they just does it. "These are not the droids we're looking for." You know, they just go. A fellow named Andrew Vanderbilge. Andrew, it's just hard to pronounce that guy's name. A lot of people know him as Brother Andrew. He had a ministry during the height of the Cold War, in the 50s and all, smuggling Bibles into communist countries. I think George did some of this too before the... You don't think George ever smuggled Bibles? That's not like George. He waited until after the doors were open. Yeah, okay. Not this guy. This guy would make trips constantly behind the Iron Curtain. And he wrote of the many, many times where the customs inspectors kept missing the Bibles that he would have hidden. Or they would look at them and they would just ignore them. God does this kind of stuff. I've known people who've smuggled Bibles into China and they've seen the same kind of thing happen. God can do these kinds of things. Verse 20, "So it was, when they had come to Samaria, that Elisha said, 'Lord, open the eyes of these men.'" Maybe it was a clapper. Clap on, clap off. What do you think? He's not going to dignify that with a look. He says, "Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see." And the Lord opened their eyes and they saw. And there they were inside Samaria. They thought they were just surrounding this little hick town, Dothan. And suddenly they find they're inside of the capital city, surrounded by the palace guards and all this kind of stuff. I imagine they were just a little bit, you know, surprised. Now, when the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them?" Now, this is King Jehoram. And he is totally blown away that he, you know, gets a knock on his front door. And he opens his front door. There's Elisha, and there's the enemy is just standing there going, and it's like, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Should I kill him? You know, what should I do? He's kind of in awe of what's going on, and at least he's asking Elisha what he should do. Verse 22, but he answered, "You shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword and your bow?" By the way, the implication is no. You wouldn't. Not everybody was ruthless. Not everybody would kill all their captives. Apparently, the kings of Israel at this time would not. He says, "Set food and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master." Then he prepared a great feast for them. And after they ate and drank, he sent them away and they went to their master. So the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. He prepared a great feast. In that day and age, sitting like having a feast like this was kind of like making a peace treaty with your enemies. And it's kind of an interesting lesson about being kind to your enemies. Jesus talked about being kind, so did Solomon. Solomon said, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat, and if he is thirsty, give him water to drink, for so you will heap coals of fire on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Being kind to your enemies. And it says they came no more. They stopped for a period of time. Only a brief period of time. But they stopped raiding Israel for a while. I can't imagine how they came back to Hadad in Damascus, the king in Damascus, and he says, "Well, where is he?" Well, the story goes like this. You know, we thought we had him in our net. We had him surrounded. And next thing you know, we were having a party with King Jehoram. I don't know how that happened. I don't know. I just... Hilarious. Verse 24. And it happened after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. So this little truce doesn't last forever. It's just for a period of time. And he decides to besiege Samaria. Samaria sits up on a hill like a lot of cities would. That's not an uncommon thing. And this is the hill of Samaria. We're going to circle around it. And so it's a bit bigger of a hill than Dothan. And so the king of Syria gathers all his army and he's going to lay siege. He's going to cut off all shipments into the city. They might have a water source, but they got no food after a while. Verse 25, and there was a great famine in Samaria, and indeed they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver and 1/4 of a cab of dove's droppings. That's not like a yellow cab. That's a measurement of 1/4 of a cab is about a pint. Of dove droppings were sold for 5 shekels of silver in the finest, more finer restaurants probably. A donkey's head. Now, we're going to go grocery shopping here. So we're going grocery shopping in the famine in Samaria. A donkey's head. Keep in mind, donkeys are unclean animals. They're useful. You can ride on donkeys. You can have them pull your carts, and you can do all kinds of good things with donkeys, but you don't eat donkeys. So good Jewish boys don't eat, and girls don't eat donkeys. Let alone, there's probably not a lot of meat on a donkey's head. You know, that's slim pickings, you know, for a donkey's head. A donkey's head is going for 80 shekels, which is, we could roughly say 10 grand in our terms. That's all. That's all you get for a donkey's head. Dove's droppings, 1/4 of a calf, that's a pint. What does a pint of dove poop cost? Well, we'll have the bird fly over, and it's $640 for a pint, 2 cups of bird poop. Who would even be eating bird poop? I mean, oh my gosh. NIV is very nice about it. They say, what do they call it? Empty seed pods. Yeah, right. All the other translations call it dove poop, a dove dung, dove droppings. Oh my gosh. The Albertsons shelves are a bit sparse. Okay? So there is famine. Verse 26. Then, as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, "Help, my lord, O king!" And he said, "If the Lord does not help you, where can I find help for you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press? Are you kidding? God's not giving us any help. You think I can do anything?" And then the king said to her, "What is troubling you?" And she answered. Now, this is a very interesting story she tells. She answered, "This woman," she's got somebody with her, "this woman said to me, 'Give me your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, 'Give your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." Now it happened when the king heard the words of the woman that he tore his clothes. And as he passed by on the wall, the people looked, and there underneath he had sackcloth on his body. He's been in mourning. He's been crying out for help. This woman is upset because the other gal wouldn't let us eat her son. And the king is horrified to see what has happened. The people are resorting to cannibalism. And very appropriately, he puts the blame right where it ought to be. Verse 31, then he said, "God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today." This is all Elisha's fault. This is all Elisha's fault. Now, I got to tell you, I used to look at this and think that he's just doing the typical thing like his daddy Ahab would do. Blame everything on Elijah. Blame everything on the prophet. But keep in mind, I think as you go through the story, especially we get into the next chapter, I think that he's been listening to Elisha, and I think Elisha's been telling him this: "Pal, you just stay put, you just wait, and you watch what God's going to do." I think that's been the message, because in a few verses we're going to see how the thing has been to wait, and he says, "I can't wait anymore." So I think that probably this is why he's blaming Elisha, because Elisha told him, "Don't do anything, just wait." And yet look at the mess that the people are in. He's still blaming the wrong person. Still blaming the wrong person. But keep in mind, I think there's a reason for him lashing out like this. Verse 32. But Elisha was sitting in his house. So he's got a house in Samaria too. He's got houses everywhere. The guy has got, he's got a little room everywhere he goes to. He's sitting in his house. And the elders were sitting with him. And the king sent a man ahead of him. But before the messenger came to him, he said, Elisha says to the elders, "Do you see how this son of a murderer has sent someone to take away my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door, hold him fast at the door. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him?" Now, a couple things to note. It's interesting, Elisha in his house, he's got the leadership sitting with him. It's the elders of Israel. That's kind of fascinating. So he's got some clout. They're sitting with Elisha. He calls Jehoram the son of a murderer because Jehoram is the son of Ahab and Jezebel. And Ahab and Jezebel were the ones that murdered a guy named Naboth to kill him in order to gain his vineyard. And he tells these elders to hold the messenger fast. Pin him at the door. He's going to send his... He knows what's going to happen. And so the messenger's going to show up. You just pin him at the door and you wait till the boss shows up, because I ain't speaking till the boss shows up. Verse 33. And while he was still talking with them, there was the messenger coming down to him. And then the king said, so the king shows up and he says, "Surely this calamity is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" So that's why I think that Elisha's been telling him, you just wait. Here he says, "Why should I wait?" Well, my friends, because we need to learn patience. God doesn't always do things in our timing. And that's a hard thing. It is a hard thing to know the balance of, when do I get up and do something, When am I guilty of not doing something? And so I got to get up and do something. And when do I just need to wait? I got to wait this thing out. I got to let things. I got to see how things will unfold. There are things that I get concerned about. People I'm concerned about, and I sometimes worry a little bit about people, and I'm trying to learn the value of being patient, because there are times when God wants to be the one doing the work, and I got to let Him do the work. I got to stop messing things up. I got to stop putting my hand in where it doesn't belong. Now, sometimes it does belong. Sometimes I do need to step up and do something. But sometimes, and that's where it's hard to know. I wrestle with this. But patience is so important, gang. It's so important that we learn to cultivate patience. James writes, you know this verse, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." We often just think of verse 3 where the goal of trials is to produce patience. Patience is not the end of it. Maturity is the end of it, being perfect, lacking nothing. And that comes with patience. Patience is just part of the step. Patience is part of what we gain through difficulty. But patience becomes a tool where I learn to grow, where I learn to mature. Because there are going to be times, just like King Jehoram, where I just need to wait. I need to wait for this. It's you wait for it, wait for it, wait for it. Sometimes I need to wait. Verse 1 of chapter 7. Then Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord." This is it. This is the time. This is the moment. This is the message that they've all been waiting for. "Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow, about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." This is it. Tomorrow, by tomorrow, this time, it will be over. Now, a seah of fine flour, price is going to drop dramatically. Currently, 1 pint of poop is 5 shekels. But by tomorrow, 6.5 quarts of flour will be 1 shekel. So prices are going to increase. That'd be wonderful. Things that the price of gasoline will be going down at the pump instead of going up at the pump. How about that? Wouldn't that be tomorrow? Tomorrow, gasoline will be 25 cents a gallon. And you might respond like the servant of the king. "Oh, if the windows of heaven were open, it could never happen. Same thing. Same kind of a dramatic change. And it mentions barley being even cheaper, because barley is a cheaper type of a grain. It's a poor man's grain, whereas flour is a little more wealthier person's grain. Verse 2. So an officer who on whose hand the king leaned, is one of this, like the king's right hand guy, he answered the man of God and said, "Look, these Christians, these prophets, look, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?" And he said, "In fact, you shall see it with your eyes, but you shall not eat of it." The windows of heaven. The concept is that the idea is that heaven is loaded with stuff. And if God made windows and popped them open a little bit and some of it kind of poured out on us, I mean, it's like, whoa, that's the picture. That's the imagery. And he says, "Oh, if there could be windows in heaven, could this thing be?" It's the most unimaginable thing, absolutely. You know, sometimes we just can't even imagine what's possible. 1962, the Decca Recording Company folks said, "We don't like their sound, and guitar music is on the way out." That was their assessment of the Beatles. Okay. Are you awake? Okay. Admiral William Leahy, U.S. Atomic Bomb Project. He said, the bomb will never go off. I speak as an expert in explosives. Just can't happen. Can't happen. Charles H. Duell, Commissioner of the U.S. Office of Patents. He wrote this in 1899. Think 1899. Head of the Office of Patents. 1899. He said, everything that can be invented has been invented. How many of us would even have a job today? The jobs that we've got today, but you know, think of all the stuff that's come just, you know, since 1899.
Oh no, nothing else can be invented. That's all been invented. You know, we're all done. You've got to be kidding me.
But we do that, gang. We think, how could this ever happen? For some of us, concepts like God loves me. I thought it was kind of cool that we sang some of the songs we sang tonight. He loves us. Oh, how he loves us. And if I really sit and think about that, you know, we can sing the songs, learn the tunes. And if you can sing high enough to sing with John, you know, you can sing along with it. But to be really absolutely honest, oh, how he loves me. Yes, he does. The unimaginable. Ephesians 3:20 says, now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. God is so huge, so big. If he could open the windows of heaven, don't catch yourself saying that. Because he could. He could pop them open at any time. Chapter 7, verse 3. Let's see if it happens. It's going to be 24 hours. It's got to be in the next chapter. It is. It is. Chapter 7, verse 3. Now there were four leprous men at the entrance of the gate, and they said to one another, why are we sitting here until we die? Four leprous men, guys with the skin disease. They're outcasts. They can't go anywhere. They got to hang out on the outside of town. And so, verse 4, if we say we will enter the city, the famine is in the city, we shall die there. And if we sit here, we die also. Now, therefore, come, let us surrender to the army of the Syrians. If they keep us alive, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall only die. I mean, we're going to die. We go into the city, we die. We stay here, we die. We go to the Syrians, we might die. Let's pick that one. Okay, so why are we sitting here? Now, this is the opposite of that patience thing that I was talking about just sitting around. There are times when our circumstances are overwhelming, and we do just sit around. And we quit all the options, and we don't even try going into the city. We just sit here. I'm just going to sit here and die. Now, there are times when you've got to get up and do something. Get up, go do something. What's the worst that can happen? What, die? That's kind of what the worst is, that we could die. Well, if we stay here, we're going to die. If we go the other way, we're going to die. So let's just try something. Teddy Roosevelt, he wrote this: the credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again because there is no effort without error and shortcomings. Who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotion, spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who have never tasted victory or defeat. Get up and do something. Get up and do something. And that's what I love about these guys. They kind of figure out, you know what? Sitting here has not fixed anything. Let's get up and let's do something. So, verse 5, they arose at twilight. Sun is setting. It's almost dark. By the time they're going to get there, it's going to be dark. So you've got to keep that in mind. This isn't the middle of the day. So at twilight, they rose to go to the camp of the Syrians, and when they had come to the outskirts of the Syrian camp, to their surprise, no one was there. For the Lord had caused the army of the Syrians to hear the noise of chariots and the noise of horses, the noise of a great army. So they said to one another, "Look, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to attack us." All they heard was noise. Therefore they arose and fled at twilight and left the camp intact, their tents, their horses, and their donkeys. And they fled for their lives. I've heard people suggest that maybe somehow it was just they thought it was the huge armies. It was just these four lepers walking down the street because they also left at twilight. I don't know. That would be actually hilarious. That'd be like one of those shows where the shadows are coming up and they're huge and they're awesome. And then you see it's just a little mouse, you know, or something like that. And they fled for their lives. Verse 8. And when these lepers came to the outskirts of the camp, they went into one tent and ate and drank and carried from it silver and gold and clothing and went and hid them. And they came back and entered into another tent and carried some from there also and went and hid it. Then they said to one another, "We are not doing right. This day is a day of good news, and we remain silent. If we wait until the morning light, some punishment will come upon us. Now, therefore, come, let us go and tell the king's household. We are not doing right." They've kind of had their fill of food, haven't eaten in a while. They had some food, and they're starting to come to their senses, and they're realizing, wait, what are we hiding? What are we holding on to all this stuff for? There's a whole city that's starving to death. And they have to go share the good news. That sound like something to you? Just have to share the good news. We have good news. We do have good news. Has he changed our lives? Yeah, it's kind of good news. Has he saved us from hell? Yeah, it's kind of good news. Is it something that's available to anybody? Yes, it is. Anybody. Paul wrote, "If I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel." We've got good news. I love the fact that they woke up and realized they've got good news to share. Verse 10. So they went and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, saying, "We went to the Syrian camp, and surprisingly, no one was there. Not a human sound, only horses and donkeys tied, and the tents intact." And the gatekeepers called out, and they told it to the king's household inside. So the king arose in the night and said to his servants, Let me now tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we are hungry. Therefore they have gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the field, saying, "When they come out of the city, we will catch them alive and get into the city." Yeah, he's suspicious. This is too good to be true. You know, that it's a trap. It's a trap. Gotta be a trap. One of his servants answered and said, "Please, let several men take 5 of the remaining horses which are left in the city. Look, they may either become like all the multitude of Israel that are left in it, or indeed, I say, they may become like the multitude of Israel left from those who are consumed. So let us send them and see." Therefore they took 2 chariots with horses. They only used 4 instead of 5 horses. They took 2 chariots, 2 chariots per horse, 2 horses per chariot. So they took 2 chariots with horses, and the king sent them in the direction of the Syrian army, saying, "Go and see." So they went after them to the Jordan, and indeed all the road was full of garments and weapons, which the Syrians had thrown away. And they're trying to run as fast as they can, so they're taking their coats off, and they're throwing their swords on the ground. So the messengers returned and told the king. They went all the way to the Jordan River. That's 25 miles. So they spend the night with their chariots going from Samaria off to the east all the way to the Jordan River and back. And they're following this trail, and then they come back. That's quite a ways. Verse 16, then the people went out. So it's the morning. The people went out and plundered the tents of the Syrians. So a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel. and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now the king had appointed the officer on whose hand he leaned. Who's that? That's the guy that was with them when they were at the day before at Elisha's house. He had appointed him to have charge of the gate. He was in charge of letting people in and out of the gate. But the people trampled him in the gate, and he died, just as the man of God had said, who spoke when the king came down to him. So it happened just as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, 2 seahs of barley for a shekel, and 1 seah of fine flour for a shekel, shall be sold tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. Then that officer had answered the man of God and said, Now look, if the Lord would make windows of heaven, could such a thing be? And he said, and he had said, In fact, you shall see it with your eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Verse 20, And so it happened to him that the people trampled him in the gate, and he died. He's trampled by hungry people. He saw the deliverance, and he wasn't able to enjoy it. I call this the price of unbelief. It appears from what Elisha has said that this man didn't benefit from the work of God because he didn't believe it was possible. Not just an accident that he got trampled by the crowd, but he didn't receive it because he didn't trust God. Our salvation works that way, doesn't it? We believe and we are saved. The Bible tells us that it's our sins that have separated us from God, and that Jesus came to die on the cross so that our sins could be paid for, and God offers us this gift of salvation if we just believe, right? If we would just believe. If we don't believe, well, John 3:18 says, He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. It doesn't just work that way with salvation. It works in all of our life. God wants to do things in our lives if we learn to trust him a little more. To trust him a little more. Hebrews 11:6 says, Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. It's not just starting with salvation. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. We have a hard time with that. We all have a hard time with trusting him. And yet, that's what it's all about. It's all about trusting him. You know, if we've got a famine in our life, an impossible situation to overcome, a person who's just impossible to put up with, we need to work at trusting him. That's kind of trusting him and patience. They go hand in hand, don't they? Trusting him and patience. That's what I find. I am quite aware of how little patience I have. How much I struggle with that. And I pray. That's part of my everyday thing, as I'm praying that God will cultivate patience, that I would cultivate patience, learn to be a little more patient. I also pray that I would be have a little more confidence in him. That's faith. That's my current hook on faith, because faith is one of those Sunday school words that we don't often define well in our head. For me, confidence is a good word that for now is working for me, that I want to be confident in him. And when I think about that, and I pray, God, help me to be more confident in you. And I think, well, why aren't I more confident? Well, of course I'm confident. I am confident in you. So then I get to the part about praying for patience, and I go, oh, okay. Okay. So if I'm confident in you and in this one situation you want me to be patient, well, then I'll be patient. And I'll be confident. Not that he's going to do the magic the way I visualize the magic happening. It's not that at all. I'm confident that he's going to do the right thing. I may not know exactly what that's going to look like. Now, Elisha, the guy had these, he got these pictures from God. He knew what was going to happen. You and I mostly don't do that. But I am confident that he knows what's good and that he's going to work it out. If I let him work it out to the whole way and not quit too quick. We read this, I think this was yesterday's reading, in Mark chapter 9. When this family was brought to Jesus, and Jesus and the boy has been demon possessed, and he says, you know, if you can help us, can you do something here? If you can help. And Jesus said, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Now, I don't know about you. I kind of choke on that because I know how little how rare it is that I believe like I probably should. But I love the way the guy responds. And he says, immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. That's a good thing. That's why I think I have permission to say, God, help me to be more confident in you. Help me to trust you. I think it's the right thing to do. Ask him to help you with your faith. Don't end up like this guy that the king leaned on, who didn't get to enjoy the things that God was planning on doing because he didn't believe. He just didn't, windows of heaven could open, that'll never happen. Oh, buddy, you're going to see it, but you'll never get to enjoy it. God help us. Let's stand and pray.